Good morning, everyone. My name is Kathleen Newland. I'm a co-founder of MPI and director of our Refugee Protection Program. And it is my great pleasure to welcome a longtime friend and distinguished scholar and critically important international civil servant on refugee issues, Alex Aleinikoff, who, as you know, is the Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva, a post that he has held for nearly 4 years now. Before going to Geneva, he was the Dean of the Georgetown University Law Center and Vice President for Law Center Affairs of Georgetown University. And that followed a distinguished career as a scholar and civil servant. He taught immigration and refugee law at Georgetown at the University of Michigan. He served in the Department of Justice in the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And because Alex is hyperactive, he at the same time is filling many of his scholarly roles. He also was a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, from which MPI developed. And he followed us to MPI as an associate here and became a member, one of the earliest members of our board. So we count Alex among the sort of founders of MPI, and it's always a great pleasure to welcome him back here. Alex was here in Washington to give a lecture, the Ryan Lecture at Georgetown University last night. I don't know how many of you had the opportunity to either attend or listen in on that, but it was a very interesting lecture, and I'm sure we'll touch on some of those themes in our conversation here. We're grateful to Alex for agreeing to come and have a more sort of informal conversation with us this morning. And probably, inevitably, Alex, I want to start with Syria, which is a huge preoccupation for UNHCR at the moment and for everyone who is concerned about refugees. For 2.5 years now, a situation that started so optimistically with peaceful demonstrations for greater democratic rights in Syria has devolved into an seemingly intractable conflict and the largest refugee crisis in a generation. And I'd like to ask you for some reflections on how UNHCR is coping with the Syrian crisis and working with the surrounding countries, the host countries, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, which have absorbed such a huge burden of refugee flows. How are you able to sort of work with those governments and assist the Syrian refugees flows? There seems to be no end in sight for those flows at the moment.
Well, before answering, let me just say hello to everyone, and really what a pleasure it is to be back here at MPI. I see a lot of friends in the audience who I haven't seen for some time. I guess it's Thanksgiving. The families all come back, and it's a way to say hello to a bunch of people. But more seriously on Syria, it's the crisis of a generation in terms of refugee flows. As you said, more than 2 million people outside the country. The responses of the bordering countries have actually been different, although all have welcomed hundreds of thousands of refugees. So in Lebanon, there have been no camps established. We identified more than 1,500 villages where refugees have settled. And so there have been about now almost 900,000 refugees in Lebanon, which has a population of 4 million people. So the impact has been just enormous. Jordan, more than 500,000 refugees. There is a camp in northern Jordan that's the one that's always featured in all the, where people go to have their picture taken in a refugee camp, the Zatri camp. There's another camp that's been built and ready, but we haven't had to officially open it yet because the Zatri's big enough to fill the needs of those in camps, but there's still hundreds of thousands of people outside of Zaatari camp inside of Jordan. Turkey responded by building a large number of camps along the Turkish border that house, I think, about 200,000 refugees now, but there may be several other 100,000 who have made their way into Turkey as well. And in Iraq, the situation has been really mainly through the Kurdistan area, refugees who have entered in. Some were put in camps, some were left out. It's been now the most of the policies to put people outside of camps or into settlements in the Kurdistan region. All told, the impact on UNHCR, of course, has been enormous, but that's less important than the impact it's had on the hosting communities and the impact on refugee lives. The situation is serious. It's very, very serious for hundreds of thousands of people. I've been to Lebanon and to Jordan, and there are people living in, in poor shelter without enough medical attention. There are hundreds of thousands of children who aren't in school, who need to be in school. Livelihoods have been disrupted. And even if there were peace tomorrow in Syria, it's not clear that there'd be a mass return because so many of the places these people fled from have been destroyed. Mm-hmm. And there's going to have to be a massive reconstruction effort in Syria before people can ever go back. But we don't see peace around the corner here. So we'll continue to see outflows of Syrians. The situation is dire for the 2 million who fled. The situation is even worse for those who have not left and were internally displaced inside Syria. The numbers are hard to calculate officially, but we count between 4 to 6 million people inside Syria who are internally displaced. And if you put that together with those who've left, you've got basically a third of the country that's been displaced. And it's hard to think of a refugee situation like where so many people in a country have been displaced. One more word on this before moving on. Because so many of the refugees, about 80% of the refugees, are not in camps, the impact on the hosting communities has been dramatic. And so what we have tried to do is, in a new way, bring in development actors into the relief effort. Typically, in the refugee business, we talk about the move from relief to development. This has been the mantra for many, many years. At the end of a refugee situation, it's time to turn it over to development actors to either locally integrate or help people go home or something. This is a situation where the development actors, we've tried to pull them in at the very beginning, during the emergency phase, which is new for development actors to work that way. So we've been working with UNDP and more particularly with the World Bank in Lebanon and in Jordan to have their efforts align with aid to the communities that the refugees have gone to. Why is this important? Because the refugee flows have been enormous and burdensome to communities, so that we have situations where rents have tripled, where wages have fallen, where schools are full, where hospitals are overflowing, where the electrical capacity or the water capacity of the infrastructure is overburdened. And so while UNHCR can raise money to take care of refugees, we need assistance to the communities so that we can preserve the asylum space, because at some point the communities will say, we can't do this anymore, or it'll create a kind of tension in the communities that will make the situation dangerous for people. So the role of the development actors is new here and important, and it's a new kind of way that we're doing our work with development agencies.
Is that attention to the development needs and the development implications of these flows something that the host countries have asked for? I mean, these enormous burdens falling on particularly border communities, but really throughout small countries, yeah, like Jordan and Lebanon, are you encountering what you feel are real dangers to people's access to crossing the border and finding safety in the surrounding countries?
I'm sorry, those are two separate questions.
I was wondering if the development actions are sort of helping to persuade the neighboring countries to keep their borders open and to accept yet more refugees.
It's hard to say. The neighboring countries have tightened on their borders. We now say the borders are managed more than open. And I think that's, obviously a function of the flow. The Lebanese border remains largely open. There's some regulations, some points. But the borders around the other countries have tightened. as the flows have gotten large. I don't think the development work will have an impact on whether how countries regulate their borders as much as hopefully building peace in the communities where refugees go. The neighboring countries have welcomed the development assistance. It's a different kind of aid, and this is what makes it difficult for humanitarian actors and development actors to work together, because the development aid tends to go to governments. It's bilateral. It goes to the governments or directly to the local governing communities, as opposed to humanitarian aid, which largely goes to refugees directly or through NGOs to refugees. And so we're trying to combine our processes and the way we work with the various actors. So the hosting countries have welcomed the assistance, but for some it is an issue, because if development aid comes as increase in sovereign debt, as it often does, then the argument the governments have to make is, why should our sovereign debt go up in order to take care of refugees? So these are things that have to get worked as we're into this new way of thinking about how we deliver our assistance.
Well, while we're on the subject of resources, how are the resource flows holding up for UNHCR? I mean, you're issuing continuing appeals. Sort of appeals.
We were at the end of it's called the RRP 5, which is the Regional Response Plan 5. The RRP 6 will be released in mid-December, just a few weeks from now. The last appeal overall was about $2.9 billion for UNHCR plus about 84 other partners. Our share of that was a little bit over $1 billion, and we've raised about two-thirds of that. So we will expect to... You know, we may well spend more than $800 million in Syria before the year is over. Now, that's a lot of money, and we've been able to do a lot with it, but it's still several hundred million dollars below what we thought was necessary just to provide for the minimal needs of people. And the concern for us is that the aid continue into 2014, because the people will still be there and the need for assistance will be at that level or even greater. And we don't want countries to think that they took care of this in one year and then move on to another crisis the next year. It's always the problem of continuing the flow when the problem hasn't been resolved.
Well, that is a situation that we are seeing increasingly. Something like half the world's refugees now are in what are considered to be protracted refugee situations. Is that the prospect for Syria, do you think, and how is UNHCR thinking about dealing with these very long-term displacements? I know the High Commissioner has been giving special attention with your encouragement to the situation of Somali refugees who've been there for 20 years. Are we going to be having this meeting in 2033 to talk about Syrian refugees?
Well, you and I probably won't be, but others in the room might be. It's too early to make a prediction on whether the Syria situation will end up as a protracted refugee situation, but I can say a couple of things about how we're thinking about that. The planning on solutions has to start early. It can't start 10 years after the flow, saying, oh, gee, I guess people haven't gone home. It's time to think about solutions. So we're aware of that. And you can, at this point, still in the emergency situation, it's difficult to do too much as the solutions, and it's certainly too early to talk about repatriation in a country that is still in the middle of a civil war. So that would not be appropriate. But we can talk about resettlement for people. It's too early to talk about local integration, is the usual of the trinity of solutions here. On resettlement, in 2014, we're hoping to find homes in third countries for 30,000. That's our goal, to have 30,000 people resettled, some through formal resettlement, some through something we're calling a humanitarian admission that the German government and other governments may work with us on, which will be kind of a temporary stay that will have a set of rights attached to it, but won't be the formal kind of resettlement. So there are flexible ways.
I'm sorry, 2014,
we're aiming for 30,000 people. Now, out of 2 million, that's not a huge number, but it is part of the way that we hope we can show the hosting states some kind of burden sharing for what they're going through. Do you want to say something more on solutions in general in Somalis, or do you?
That's one of the extreme cases where you've had people literally in refugee camps, although there are many Somalis in the surrounding, in the cities and towns of the surrounding countries, but with 100,000 refugees in Dadaab camp, some of them now third generation, it seems unsustainable, and yes, it's been sustained for 20 years now. What's the responsibility of the international community to really restart normal lives for these people, or something much more like normal lives?
Yeah, no, I think there is a responsibility. I mean, we have had these situations. I think after the emergencies are over, and we've worked with a group of NGOs, and the international community has either built camps or provided assistance, we tend to just continue that process, thinking that, well, maybe next year will be the year that the situation can be solved. And we find ourselves down the road in 30 different protracted refugee situations in 25 countries affecting, 5 million refugees. And the estimates are that the average length of time that someone spends as a refugee is 17 years. And that's not acceptable. The refugee protection is special protection. In some ways, it comes with a set of rights under the convention that are important, and important to saving lives and sustaining lives. But it was never intended to be a permanent status. It was always on the way to a solution, to reinsertion into a community where one could live a normal life. And I quite frankly think the world has given up on this, and we can't. I mean, this really is a moral obligation. I make an argument in a piece that will be out in the Virginia Journal of International Law in a month, if I can make a plug for it, that there's actually a legal duty of the international community to attempt to solve these problems. But I think there's a sense in which the donor states, the West, the developed countries, can think, well, look, we've taken care of basic guarantee of no refoulement. People are safe, they're not being sent back. So, and we're providing assistance, so people aren't sent back and they're taken care of. But there's no duty beyond us to try to seek to solve these situations. But as you mentioned, the Dadaab camp, our best guess is that we've got 10,000 children who were born to parents who were born in the camp. And that's just not acceptable. It's like, I've used this analogy before, but it's like in cases of domestic violence, if a woman has fled a violent situation at home and gone to a safe house for safety, and she's there 15 years later. I mean, that's not the goal of the refugee system. The goal of the refugee system is not simply no refoulement. That's the first step. But the goal is to have people live normal lives, either back in their country of origin, locally integrated, or resettled elsewhere. And that has to be a commitment of the international community. We have to come head on to these. Now, the problem is that the reason we have protracted situations is because the traditional remedies don't work, right? I mean, no one wants these. It's not as if we're not trying to solve these situations, but it's not safe to go back, take Somalis. It's against the policies of the hosting states to allow large-scale local integration. And the resettlement, even if we have a plan for settling tens of thousands of people out of the camps, you probably exceed that number with births in the camp every year. So the solutions don't work. So then you've got to think in new ways about what to do.
Well, one of your responsibilities at UNHCR, which I find very intriguing, is you're in charge of innovation.
Yeah.
Is this a big part of your innovation brief?
No, I can say more. That's
okay. Well, we'll come back. We'll come back to that. But, let's stick with alternate solutions for protracted situations for a moment.
This is conceptual in innovation. I think the way to think about this is that we need to think about steps towards solutions. If we can't have immediate solutions, how do we begin to help people to live more robust lives, become more self-reliant? Because what we've actually done, we don't comment on this and we don't notice it enough, but we have created long-standing situations of dependency for refugees. I go to a refugee camp and I see people, whether they've been there 6 months or a year or 2 years, you can think, a few years ago, these people were leading normal lives in their home countries. They were herders or farmers or shopkeepers or teachers, and they were taking care of their children the way like we all do in whatever circumstances they found themselves. And yet, in a camp situation, often they're not permitted to work, which is a violation of the convention from my perspective. They're often kept largely confined to the camp, although there's some kind of movement in or out. And there's not large-scale investment in the camp in terms of industry, commerce, business. There's not the infusion of capital that allows people to work, and they're often not ties with the hosting communities that permit that kind of work. And all that can be opened up. We can think about situations of building employment opportunities in association with the local community. Now, the answer of the hosting countries always is, if you let people work and let them out, they won't go home. And the goal is for refugees eventually to go home, which is, I mean, I understand why hosting states would say that. And moreover, the international community should be, again, sharing the burden of people. And we don't want refugees competing with our local folks for jobs, which is what's happened in Lebanon and Jordan, where, as I said, wages have dropped because you suddenly have a large new labor force willing to work for less money. Those are real concerns of the hosting communities. So you have to come up with strategies that appeal to the interests of the hosting communities. I'll just give one example of this that comes out of our Ethiopian camps. We have five camps in Dolorado, Ethiopia, which is on the Somali border with Ethiopia, and about 160,000, 170,000 refugees who started coming after the 2011 drought and conflict in South Central Somalia, and they were put in camps. And we worked actually closely with the IKEA Foundation, who gave us a good chunk of money over a three-year period to think in new ways about how to run camps. First of all, to make sure kids get to school and they're taken care of, and the normal ways that we like to do assistance but never have enough money to do as much as we'd like. But they also said, think about how to, you know, in a more of a private sector mode, how to make people's lives more meaningful for them, more towards self-reliance. And so we're in the process of thinking about what livelihoods projects might be. But one thing we've done is there's a river that runs by these five camps that runs with water all year long. And there's fertile ground there that hadn't been used. And we've now put together a project with the host community who owns the land and refugees who supply the labor to use this land to grow crops. And it's just beginning, but I've walked through these fields. I've seen the crops growing, and the crops then come back. Half the produce goes to the local community as owners, and half goes to the refugees as those workers who produced it, which hopefully will produce a bit of a market for consumption, but also a market for the crops, which will bring money into the camps that will then allow other businesses to kind of grow. So I think what we need to think about are development, again, the approach from development actors who can think about development in the area as a whole, what role refugees can play in that, and then developing economies that include the camps rather than the situation what we have, which, quite frankly, we're all complicit in. I mean, NGOs, UNHCR, the international community, we are complicit in a system that year after year provides assistance. And that's just not sustainable. It's not good for no refugee wants that. And it's not sustainable for the international community. I'm going on here, but let me just say one more word about this, because you can tell I'm interested in these topics. I was at our camps recently on the Thai border that have housed about 120,000 Myanmarese refugees now for over 30 years. And these are camps that are located actually in a beautiful setting against a hill in the middle of a forest that's a fertile place for agriculture, and people are well taken care of. There's medical care. There's schools for kids. I mean, so in a way, it's a nice functioning refugee camp. But 30 years later, we are still bringing food into this camp. I mean, that cannot make sense, right? There has to be a way for people to either be able to grow crops or to have industry or some kind of job environment that allows them to have the money to buy food or grow food or the like. And what's even a bit odder about this is that there are 2 million Myanmarese migrant workers allowed to work in Thailand. But the 120,000 refugees are denied work authorization, basically kept in the camp. And that's just is not a good situation. And that's just one instance around the world where the international community does We've saved lives. We have helped people live in these communities. But it's time now to let the people live the normal kind of life through. And so if we, I think, undertake these kinds of programs, we are actually moving people towards solutions. Let me, final word on this. So people say, well, not really, because you're then furthering local integration. People will never go home. So I think the attitude has to be that we are providing people with skills and livelihoods that will help their return. So in talking to the refugee community in the Thai camp that I visited, they knew eventually it's going to be time to go home. The Myanmar is changing slowly. There is not a formal peace agreement yet, but we expect over years coming that there'll be time to go home. They said, teach us skills that we can take back with us to go home. And so if we were to do, say, a survey in the country of origin and identify the skills needed and train those skills in the camps we have, then I think you can actually argue that these kinds of self-reliance strategies are in service of the longer solution. So long
it's
answer.
So no, that, it's so ironic that in a time when we're beginning to talk with great concern about, you know, competition for talent and the need for a global market in mid skills as well as the very high skills, that we have these pools of people who would love to take up occupations and exercise them being sort of warehoused. I want to ask you one just a sort of parentheses about the Philippines before we go on to talk about innovation in UNHCR. UNHCR is sort of the primary humanitarian actor in so many situations. And yet there are those who, you know, are concerned that its mandate is broadening so far beyond refugees that it's going to stretch your resources, including your human and sort of administrative resources. But in a situation like the Philippines, it's hard to see how UNHCR can sort of sit back and say, oh, no, this is not our problem. How do you square that circle?
Yeah, natural disasters are not part of our mandate, and as actually, you know, probably 4 or 5 years ago, was there hadn't been a refugee crisis for some time, we started to think, well, maybe we have other work we could do in the world that's good, and maybe we should be doing more work in natural disasters. But that talk has gone away from the agency, because over the past 3 or 4 years, besides Syria with Mali and Sudan and the DRC and the Central African Republic, on and on and on, we've had more crises, more simultaneous crises than any time in our history. So we are, you know, refugees are us. That's the business at the moment, and we can talk about natural disasters at another time. When we are in a country and there's a humanitarian need, we're going to respond. I mean, a couple of years ago in the floods in Pakistan, where 1 million people were displaced because of floods, we had tents in Pakistan, and we provided tents to put a 1 million people under shelter. I mean, we will do that. When there was an earthquake in Turkey a couple of years ago, we provided a shelter for people. So if we are there and we have the ability to respond, we will. Now, some of our donors say, well, you shouldn't be spending money, refugee money, on this, but inevitably we raise additional money. So in the aid we're providing in the Philippines, we've raised enough money to take care of. What happened in the Philippines is actually the first two trucks that arrived with aid in the Philippines were UNHCR trucks. I mean, we after a day or two after Tacloban, while people were there, we had two staff members. This is typical resourcefulness of the organization, who drove trucks from another island, got on a ferry, and brought the trucks to Tacloban. That was a small amount of aid for hundreds of thousands of people, but they were there. And we will continue to do that when we have the ability. So far, contribution is fairly small. It's, I think, been about $15 million in assistance, and we'll a tiny portion of overall what's needed. But we will continue to do that through our good offices when we have the ability and to do it, without saying that is now part of our mandate. And there are important differences. You know, I think in some places there's a push to have a single humanitarian organization that can respond to everything. And people have different views on this, and I won't get into the overall debate. And it usually involves a fair amount of turf fighting, as you can imagine, among a UN and other organizations. But there are, the more I've thought about this, it occurs to me there are fundamental differences between among assisting refugees internally displaced by conflict and internally displaced by disaster. If I take a minute to say something about this. people internally displaced by disaster are citizens of the home of the country they're in, and inevitably the state wants to help out and just lacks the means to do so. The Philippine government has a large scale disaster relief program, and these are their citizens, and they want to go and help, and they just need the extra help because the disaster was more than anybody expected. So they welcome the international help to come in and do what they are already capable of doing. They fully embrace people as their citizens. In an IDP situation born by conflict, you may not have that desire of the government to fully help everyone in the country, because some of the people displaced may be fighting on the other side. There may be obvious examples to you about that. In a refugee situation, you have people who've come across a border who aren't citizens of the country into which they've fled. And that then may lead the country to say, these aren't our people. We're happy to open up the border and give them a place to stay, but international community, we all have to do this together, so we need more assistance. So the kind of response there and the sense of responsibility of the state in which the displaced people exist, it varies, I think, among those three categories, which may call for different legal norms, different legal structures, different institutional structures to respond. But again, it doesn't mean that if we're mainly worried about refugees, we're not going to help. We're in a country and we have the ability to do so.
Excuse me. Well, let's turn to the larger question of innovation at UNHCR and UNHCR within the UN system. There's a great deal of discussion now about development goals and sort of new frameworks and so on. Where does UNHCR enter into that conversation?
Well, again, that's not quite how I think about innovation, but I'll respond to that one as well. We'll get to innovation.
And then tell us how you think about innovation.
Innovation, okay, good. Yeah. Look, there will be a big discussion later on in the UN after 2015 and the move from the Millennium Development Goals to the Sustainable Development Goals. And this is important. I mean, the UN development issues are front and center for the UN. And refugees are just a small slice of the number of people found in situations in countries that need significant help in terms of assistance, development solutions, and the like. We have a role in the development discussions, but not a major role. I mean,
Hard even to get migrants, yeah, much less refugees.
Exactly.
Into
and we certainly want the development debate to go on in a way that's sensitive to protection of refugee issues, sensitive to the fact that there will be large flows of people through migration, refugee, forced displacement by climate, whatever, that have to be taken into account as one thinks about development. Or even in the Syria situation, if there's peace in Syria and Syria is to be rebuilt, you can't do that without thinking about the 2 million people that may come back into the country. So you have to, you can't close your eyes to migration as you think about development. That has to be a part of it. But it's not I wouldn't say it's a central driver. It just needs to be one of the things on the list that one that one thinks about. What we've noticed, though, as I've said, development is really involved in our work now in three different stages. First, from this relief to development I talked about before, which I don't like the phrase relief from development, is if you're handing off a baton to, because it always gets dropped if you do it that way. I mean, you have to, we have solutions programs now that we call the Transitional Solutions Initiative, which is both basically examples of ways to take village camps in East Sudan that have been there for 40 years and turn them into villages, by extending local services, by creating livelihoods, and the like. And that is a joint project of UNHCR and UNDP, because we have, you know, similar, I mean, we have complementary skills in making those things happen. So that, in that situation, solutions, there's a role for development and solutions thinking. Then there's a role in this middle stage I've described, which the Dolo Ado, those are the camps in Ethiopia. After the emergency's over, how do we begin a livelihood strategy? If you fit that into an overall development approach for the region, that's, I think, the most successful way you can make that come about. And then the Syria situation has development actors now in the emergency phase. So in all these places, we are discovering new ways in which we're trying to work with the development actors. That's how, at least from our perspective, the role of development. Now, innovation, the High Commissioner asked me to formal innovation group a couple of years ago at UNHCR, and we've started slow not to sort of launch, innovation is kind of one of these words like resilience, sort of very, a current word that everyone wants to say they're in the middle of doing. And we wanted to start basically from the ground up on this. And because what I found is I traveled to any of our operations, there were people, staff members, doing really interesting things that no one knew anything about. For a couple of reasons. One, they thought if they told headquarters, they'd be told to stop doing it. It's the usual way that UN organizations deal with innovation is, gee, I don't see that written anywhere here. I'm not sure you can do that, but so there was a sense that it would be squashed. I'm not sure it was always accurate, but that was a sense. Don't tell anyone we're doing this. But even for things that worked well and people were happy about, we didn't have a way of taking what was done and telling it to others, because after 60 years of experience and in hundreds of different situations, we've learned a lot about things, but we have not been good at sharing those, what we call best practices. And thirdly, we had problems that we didn't have solutions to. And that's whether you can build a better latrine, depending on the climate, or a cook stove that works. Everyone and his brother has created a new cook stove for renewable energy, and they come and try to sell them to us. And, we take these global, these solar wonderful cook stoves, and then we find in a refugee camp that people are using them as closets. They're storing things in them because they couldn't cook the food that people wanted to cook. It wasn't culturally appropriate for people. So we're trying to do this to re-engineer this. So we're going to probably launch a cook stove project, but what we're going to do is go out to refugee communities, try to identify, four or five different situations, because it's going to be culturally different. It'll be different based on climate and the kind of fuel you have. And then from that, come up with a set of specifications that then we can try to solve. And so what my job has been to do is to put together a group that links problems in the field with outside partners who want to work with us. And so we have worked with the IKEA Foundation and with UPS, and with some of the tech industry on some distance learning and other kinds of educational activities, and with SAP on helping us to think about how to build a better way to communicate with them. So we're reaching out to outside companies, and I always tell them I want them to work for free. This is not a business proposition. If they want to join us, please come do it. We find that we actually, people want to work on these problems and solve humanitarian problems. And then beyond just UNHCR, there are a lot of problems that are shared with other humanitarian organizations. So I've just begun to work now. I've formed a sort of a collaborative, because I want to keep this as informal as possible and not bureaucratize it, but worked, put together a small group that we're just forming with UNICEF and UNDP and WFP and UNFPA and others to say, you all have innovation units, and rather than working apart, why don't we try to pool resources, see if there's some common problems we want to solve together, and then move it. The goal is to become a 21st century organization sometime in the 21st century. That's the goal here.
Good to be ambitious.
I think I'll do one other example of this, which is kind of a cool thing.
You cite this example, yeah. I want to open.
Okay,
open
I'm sorry,
this
I'm talking,
to.
I'm talking too much.
But
there's there's social networking innovation software now. So we partnered with a company called a Spigot that does this. And we created something we called UNHCR Ideas. And the way it works is we put a challenge out. And I think the challenge was, how can we better communicate with our urban refugee population? And people from around the agency could sign up. And 250 people, we stopped after 200 people, 250 people signed up. And the way this is social networking, so people would put out ideas, people would comment on ideas, they'd refine the ideas, and the ones that got the most comments kind of trickled up to the top. And then there was a selection panel for the best 10 ideas, and then finally there was a winner that we chose. But from this, we got extraordinary suggestions, both from, not only from staff, but then comments from other staff that refine these ideas. And it is the power of the wiki. I mean, just, 250 UNHCR minds working on a problem are going to get somewhere. And that's the kind of strength we're trying to build. And eventually we'll open this up to NGOs and private sector and really, and make, you know, have different kinds of challenges on different topics. The last one I'll mention here is on housing, where a few years ago, actually before innovation started, though we've now adopted this project through another gift from the IKEA Foundation, we went to literally 15 different Swedish companies and said, there is no transitional shelter. We go from the tent, and people stay in tents too long, and they're not comfortable, and they need replacement after 6 months. We need to build a modern thing. IKEA would be the right guys, right? It comes out flat pack box and stuff. But they did. After a couple of years, they put together a structure that we're now testing, and then we found some in the testing that needs some refinement. But it's a stronger structure. It's still lightweight. It'll probably cost maybe twice what a tent does, but it'll last four or five times longer than a tent. It can be assembled in half a day or a day, and it'll be a structure people can live in. And that was a place where there was no market. It wasn't being produced. And through working again with the private sector, we were able to bring them in and try to produce this new way of working. So I think there's a lot that can be done with outside partners on solving humanitarian problems. And this is a new thing. I mean, this really is a new way for working for the UN, is to recognize we're not the experts. We can reach out, find people who want to work for free with us to develop these kinds of solutions, and really expand the notion of partnership, which often just means, you know, taking and not really working towards a problem. And people want to do that. People want to be involved in helping solve the world's problems. It's a wonderful thing.
That's a fabulous idea. And I think when you also get to the point of being able to involve refugees in those social networks in a major way to identify and solve problems, that will have real transformative power at a number of different levels. Great. So I want to take your comments and questions. And there's a gentleman in the corner over there who has his hand up. And
just following up on that point, my name is Doug Brooks, and
thank you.
Your point about the sort of temporary housing or the semi-permanent housing, thank you, about the semi-permanent housing, I work with the private sector quite a bit, and a number of these companies that have innovative ideas in terms of semi-permanent housing have been trying to get into this market for a long time. The big issue has always been the political side, because nobody wants a semi-permanent city in their country. I'm just wondering, is there any movement on that? I mean, what you just said about the Swedish companies is great, but it's just it's a drop in the bucket compared to what could be done in terms of, you know, private sector assistance for this.
On housing in particular, or more generally?
Generally.
Okay. Yeah. There are lots of opportunities here. I mean, look, just on the shelter side, there are lots of shelter solutions out there, but we did a request for information and got, you know, again, everybody had a shelter solution, but they didn't work for us. They weren't either right for refugees, or they were too expensive, or they were too heavy. So that's why we developed our own product according to our specifications. You know, there was just an article probably people saw, it was either in the Times or the Post, about the Gates challenge on building a toilet, and they built a great toilet. The problem is it cost $1,000. We can't do that. We don't need, you know, the fanciest. We need something that works, and we need an IKEA product, right? We need something that's cheap, easy to build, and lasts. But there is a problem. You're right that the hosting, I mean, all these things end up being political, because the hosting governments, if their goal is not to make these camps look permanent or refugees, the goal is to return people, if you build a city out of stuff that looks permanent, they'll say that's the message. So part of that is these things are built so they can be taken down and removed and taken home by the refugee, or they can be left for the host community to use as they want to use. But that's a negotiation. So we've had in some countries, we've said, can we test these? They said, no, we're not interested, just for this reason. Others say, sure, we need the shelter. So they all have to be negotiated. We are inundated with people with great ideas for us. You know, people who, again, just invented the latest straw that purifies water, and if we'd only buy 50,000 of these, you know, everybody's life would be improved. And that may well be true, but it is difficult for us to test those things, to actually buy them. We sometimes find that local solutions end up being cheaper and more culturally appropriate than the latest technological advance. And I think the right way to work this is, just as Kathleen said, actually, is to start with refugees and say, how do you do stuff? And, I mean, there have been books written now about reverse innovation, right, which means often what companies do is they invent something to the developed world and then see if they can sell it in the developing world. How do they adapt it? And the idea is actually start in the developing world, because you might end up with a cheaper, more appropriate product that then you can take the developing world to the developed world as a manufacturer, or you work with it in the developing world. And this is what I'm saying on the cook stove. Start with the refugees and say, what are you cooking? How are you cooking? What time of day do you cook? What kind of fuel do you need? And then go out and look for someone to build that product rather than trying to evaluate the hundreds of thousands of products that are out there and see whether they're appropriate. So we need to get the private sector involved in learning from the refugees on the ground and then working with us to develop products. And we need them to do it for free. That's the thing.
And then you need them to use the refugees themselves as the labor force to build those,
which
those
is what,
products.
Which is what we do. We have housing we're building in Ethiopia. And there's been a shop, the Norwegian refugee. It's either Norwegian or Danish, I should know. But it's one of the refugee councils of the Nordics that put up a shop. And local community people work in it and refugee people work in it. And they build structures.
Great stuff. Yeah. Patricia?
In Georgetown University. Hello, welcome. I want to come back to two words you said in your last comment, which were urban refugees. Mm-hmm. And if ever there is a movement from the base of people who wanted normal lives, urban refugees defines it. People who don't want to be in camps, they want normal lives, they want to innovate, they want to be in charge of themselves, therefore they go to cities, all kinds of cities, not just the big ones we know about. And then there are the IDPs, and then there are the disaster victims. So everybody accumulates there. And this is, it seems to me, where innovation is desperately needed and underway. And I know it's underway. So I wonder if you could go back to the Syria example, the refugees in the neighboring countries of Syria who are not in camps, who are in the various dozens of cities, and say something about what's happening in those venues. Thank you.
Yeah, as I said, yeah.
They are everywhere in Turkey.
Right. Yeah. Maybe half the refugees are in urban situations in Turkey as well. Right now, in the emergency stage, we're still really invested in emergency relief, no matter where people are located. So making sure there are clinics that people can go to, or expanding clinics or building new clinics, bringing in doctors, expanding schools or building new schools. So those are, adding to the urban infrastructure is crucial. Secondly, is the use increasingly of cash, I think, is a huge innovation throughout the humanitarian sector, that rather than shipping in food, give people cash and let them buy food, or rather than, giving them non-food items, give them cash and let them buy what they need. So often, sometimes, we hand out non-food items and then we see them for sale in the market later. People turn them into, they monetize them and then spend the cash how they want. And I think we're increasingly moving to the idea of this. And in Jordan, actually, people have ATM cards and they go there. There's a biometric, it's pretty high-tech stuff, but there's an iris scan where they walk up to the ATM. There's cards that's put on by the humanitarian organization onto the card. Their eyeballs are scanned and the money comes out of the machine. So this stuff is happening, and that's the right way to go, to be flexible in those kinds of forms of relief.
There's never really been a demand until fairly recently for humanitarian organizations to be economically literate and to really understand how local economies work and so on.
Well, that's what we have to get smart about. I think the other thing about that, Pat, is the right to work. Many countries, refugees do not have the right to work. The convention guarantees a right to work. And I think that is the unlocking that, unlock a key. That's the key to unlock the self-reliance vault. I don't know. Forget the metaphor. But the right to work is crucial.
We've got the picture.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Could we have the lady on the aisle up here, and then after you, perhaps you could pass it to the young
Thanks.
Lady.
Thanks, Pat Saper from Catholic News Service. Going back to Syria again, in conversations with people with Catholic Relief Services, I've been covering migration and refugees for 20 years, and I've never heard them so scared about what's happening to people on the ground. So protective. Oh, you have to. What I told you, so you can't identify where those people are, where we're working, who we're working with. Is Syria particularly more dangerous for aiding refugees than other situations have been? How is this situation as a security matter for you?
In the hosting countries, there are always security issues, but in the hosting countries, we perform our work fairly unfettered. I mean, there are other hosting countries where, you know, if I travel, I have an armed escort. That's not true in these hosting countries. There's order, there's security for refugees. It doesn't mean they live insecure lives in the sense that many are in poor shelter and don't have jobs. I mean, so it's that kind of insecurity, sort of in human security terms, but not in the physical security. Now, they may well have security issues if their names are known and it's broadcast back home and they're on the wrong side of whoever is fighting whatever side the other side is. So in typical way, we don't release that kind of information ever. We never do that in any situation. We don't release personal information about refugees because if they're a refugee, they've fled a dangerous situation. You don't want to harm the family that may be left behind or make other problems for them. So, but in terms of physical security, I don't think it's any more serious and maybe less serious than other places. In terms of for internally displaced in Syria, it's incredibly insecure. I mean, bombings continue, suicide bombs go off, we saw the use of chemical weapons. I mean, it's awful. It's a civil war, and 120,000 human beings have died in that war. In the 21st century, we have watched this happen. It is a tragedy.
How is that affecting what UNHCR is doing in Syria?
Our staff is incredibly brave. We have staff members in Syria. They've been in Damascus since the start. We had a strong program in Damascus for years because we took care of 100,000 Iraqi refugees inside Damascus for years. So we have been in Damascus for a long time. We know Damascus. But most of our staff are either working at home or they're in one hotel in the middle of Damascus. Bombs go off around them. I mean, this is serious, really serious stuff. We've been conducting cross-line operations and convoys with other UN partners. We're not alone in this. UNICEF is with us and other organizations. The Syrian Red Crescent does this as well. But you're going across a battle line. You're going from one area to another, and you're always subject to potential violence. We've lost a couple of workers, not directly targeted, but as in other, you know, just because it's a dangerous situation. So it's tough. It's tough to work. Now, we have actually delivered a fair amount of assistance inside Syria, and 40% of that assistance has gone to opposition-held areas. We've been able to get it in. The difficult thing has been that the international community, the emergency relief coordinator, Valerie Amos, has gone to the Security Council and asked the Security Council for a resolution that would permit cross-border assistance because there are hundreds of thousands of people throughout the country, or millions, but there are many, for example, along the Turkish border in IDP situation that need assistance. And some aid is going in, but the UN organizations cannot cross that border because under our rules we can't enter a sovereign state without the state's permission unless the Security Council votes approval. So the ERC, the Emergency Relief Coordinator, asked for that. It was not voted on by that. But despite that, we have been able nonetheless to do this work inside the country. We have begun now also to bring in some other from other places, bring in and restock our warehouses that we've had in Syria for some time. So we are reaching people inside, not nearly as many as we'd like, and it is incredibly dangerous.
Hello, my name is Maria Valander, and I'm a student at the George Washington University. You talked about the opportunities that occur when there are like rivers and arable land available to refugees to work. But in many of these countries where there are refugees, there is a scarcity of natural resources. And also in looking at sustainable solutions, you have to see at how to minimize the degradation of those resources, both for, you know, the host countries and for when these refugees return to their countries. So how does the UNHCR work to offset degradation of natural resources around refugee camps? And also, how do they offset kind of the strain of natural resources in these host countries?
Yeah, this is a serious problem. And we actually, when part of the ending of a camp situation is reforestation or rehabilitation. This is built into our plans, and we know that that's part of our obligation. So I mean, we're aware of this, that when you have a large number of people and flow into an area that has not a large number of people, there'll be environmental impacts. So we are attuned to that. And part of the search for a cook stove is to look for cook stoves that use renewable energy. We also have developed cook stoves that they're much more efficient even when they use wood, because looking for wood is an issue about taking wood resources or women who have to walk to dangerous places to get wood. And so that's, I mean, we're very sensitive to these issues. Doesn't mean we always are able to do everything we'd like, but this is part of the way we approach a problem.
Thank you, and we'll finish up in this corner.
Thanks a lot. My name is Uffe Jensen. I'm from the EU delegation here in Washington. There's one of the groups who has been hit twice in the Syrian crisis, and that's the Palestinian refugees. There's a lot of issues we can discuss about the Palestinians, but how do you see, how does the Syrian crisis affect the longer term prospects for the Palestinian refugees in the region, being in Jordan, being in Syria, being in Lebanon especially, and perhaps the prospect of going back to where they came from?
Well, actually, this is one question I can duck, because the UNHCR's jurisdiction does not extend to Palestinian refugees in these countries, so this is UNRWA's responsibility. Yeah, but we're aware of the impact on Palestinians. We work very closely with UNRWA, and while we've made comments about the importance of aiding non-Palestinian refugees in the region, we've also said the same thing, that assistance is needed for Palestinian refugees who have been pushed out of places because of the fighting. We urge countries to leave their borders open for Palestinian refugees as well as for other refugees. How it affects overall settlement in the Middle East, I don't hazard a guess on.
Yeah, if I could just comment briefly, I think before the civil war started, Palestinian refugees in Syria were particularly well integrated. It was considered to be the sort of the best place to be a Palestinian refugee, including Palestine in some cases. It was also a very good example of the way that refugees can be an asset to a country. They had UNRWA technical training schools supplying technicians to the local hospitals and really filling gaps in the labor market. So it's in some ways it's a double tragedy for the people, of course, but also for the country that the very constructive relationship between Palestinian refugees and the Syrian economy was a role model in some ways, and I certainly hope it can be reconstructed. Could we have a question here?
Thank you for your talk. I'm Tabassum Siraj from the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and you were mentioning that 30,000 Syrians might be accepted for resettlement. Are you talking to PRM about this?
Of course. Yeah, no, we expect a large group to come to the United States. Now, sometimes there's issues on security clearances and the like, but we hope that'll all be worked out. And, you know, the United States resettles more than half of the world's resettled refugees, and we would hope and expect the United States to play a major role in that resettlement.
Thank you. One more question. You mentioned innovation, and we've been talking mainly about development, but how about peace building? Because when we have large influxes of a population, there's a lot of tension with the host community. So is there any work going on there to build bridges between the communities other than just financial help that will ease the burden?
In the middle of a crisis or an existing refugee situation, part of our protection effort is a community-based approach that tries to work when you don't have people in camps, but in villages, is to work on what you call peace-building efforts or other kinds of projects that pull people together and create a stable and welcoming environment for refugees. That's part of the work we do. More broadly, there is a peace-building fund at the UN that does offer, you know, makes grants for peace-building operations. A couple of years ago, the Secretary General adopted a policy on returning IDPs and refugees and attempts to invoke parts of that is the peace-building fund to help out on when people reintegrate into societies. How do you make sure that the infrastructure is there, development is there, that makes that a stable and peaceful kind of reintroduction into those communities?
Hi, I'm Bernadette Passad Cisse. Hello. Used to be with UNHCR. I wanted to ask, how would you characterize U.S. congressional support for UNHCR's work?
Very strong. I mean, this year, UNHCR, but in 2013, we've already received more than $1 billion from the United States government. It's the highest amount ever. And that's money that's appropriated from the United States by Congress to PRM, as was just mentioned, the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. And then they hand that money out to a range of different organizations. But we have received from PRM more than $1 billion this year, which is an extraordinary amount. We could not do the work, and the United States remains by far our largest, most important funder. And as we talk about this issue on the Hill and meet with people to we're not a lobbying organization, but people ask us for our, you know, views on what the situation is like. This is a nonpartisan issue. We have support from Democrats and Republicans and all varieties of Democrats and Republicans because this is a country that was built on the ideal of refuge. I mean, this is in our DNA to welcome refugees here. We're coming up to, I guess, the Thanksgiving period and the idea of the pilgrims having fled political persecution, religious persecution. But this country welcomes refugees. And this goes back actually to the ORR program. I mean, one of the really interesting things the United States does, which is not done, I don't think, in any other country, is first of all, the large-scale resettlement. But also, the fact that the resettlement is carried out by voluntary organizations here, mainly religious organizations. And so refugees are resettled in small communities all around the United States. And I think that helps build support for refugees. So you don't see a situation where, you know, there are 100,000 refugees who've come to Savannah, Georgia, you know, and that's suddenly an issue. But there might be two refugees that go to Savannah, Georgia, because the Lutherans have settled someone in Savannah, making Savannah, Georgia, who knows. But this is replicated, you know, all around the United States, I think, in effect. Now, often people then, refugees come and get together. So there's a large Somali community in Minneapolis, say, for example, and a Hmong community. And so people will eventually come together. But the initial move of this kind of grassroots resettlement, I guess, is the best way to describe it, I think it helps build this this interest and concern. But it wouldn't happen if these communities weren't open to the idea of taking care of the refugee to start. And I mean, give me your tired, your poor. I mean, it's just part of our national spirit. Now I'm stepping back into the role of American citizen rather than, what'd you call me, international civil servant? Thank you for that lovely description, Kathleen. You know, this is a wonderful part of this nation's heritage, and it's led to the enormous support we get from the U.S. government and from the American people.
I should describe you as an international political appointee. Is that better? did we have a question on this side at the front? Thank you.
William Houston, I'm an independent writer. Just a question about Syria. As the fighting it's becoming more prevalent in Damascus, still in the suburbs, but is there work being done to prepare with, like, Jordan, since it's right by Damascus? If fighting increases in Damascus, are you prepared for the large influx of refugees that come out of there? And what kind of work are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, we have contingency plans. The RRP5 I described was actually a contingency plan that could handle up to 3.5 million refugees. We're only at just over 2 million, but we have planning in place that would take care of a larger flow. Yeah.
Yes, let's go back to this side, please.
Hi, I'm Nora Skelly with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. We actually do resettle in Savannah.
See that? Okay,
yeah.
I knew it.
We're hearing really good things so far. I have a question. I was just wondering if you could comment on the situation of unaccompanied children in any of the contexts that you mentioned or in other parts of the world, particularly in Latin America.
Well, I won't, I mean, let me, what I'll talk about is not Latin America, but Northern Ethiopia. I think the most troubling and heartbreaking situation I've been in was in northern Ethiopia, where I went to a camp for Eritreans, and the Eritrean flow has been persistent out of Eritrea into northern Ethiopia for years, and it's continued. And a lot of the people who come out are unaccompanied minors, either smuggled out or they're trying to find. I mean, I talked to one kid whose mother was in Norway, and he was trying to get there, Some of them are leaving because they don't want to be conscripted into the army. There are lots of reasons why people leave. But in this camp in northern Ethiopia, there were 1,000 unaccompanied minor kids. and they were living in concrete shelters, 7 or 8. I went to one of the boys that were about from age 7 to 16. And kids can't grow up that way. They shouldn't be living that way. And we were basically running a large orphanage, exactly. But we weren't providing the services that these kids needed to thrive. And I came back from that and said, we can't do this. We have to pull in other kinds of resources. And we've since gone out now with a plan on actually for Eritrean kids there, but also in Egypt, Sudan. There's a fourth country now I'm forgetting because we were able to identify other situations where this was true. But I think this requires more. I mean, I'm not faulting our Ethiopian operation. This was beyond their ability to cope with. And we did have a partner there who was trying as well, but it requires additional resources and it requires new kinds of thinking. And it's not an easy situation because one of the arguments is if you take care of these kids well and, you know, give them the card, you'll just spark more departures from Eritrea. So you can't just simply say, oh, we got to put all these kids in, you know, brilliant foster care and get them. But you can't leave 1,000 children in this situation. So we're looking for alternatives about some kind of home care arrangements or resettlement opportunities or additional resources. But I think this actually needs to be an effort of a kind of consortium of major NGOs and UNHCR and UNICEF and other organizations that say we can't have these. These were almost, you know, these are the lost kids of Eritrea. And it was just really, as I said, it was heartbreaking to see. And we've now taken steps to do something about this, but we need to do more.
Hi, I'm Esmeralda from the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, and my question is kind of in relation to what happened in the Philippines and is happening. And I understand that the UNHCR isn't necessarily, it's not your mandate to deal with displaced people, especially internally, due to climate change issues or environmental disasters. But however, as climate change seems to be coming more evident, what are your thoughts really on how to address people who are displaced due to climate change or environmental issues?
Yeah, this is a gap in the international legal regime. We don't have rules or norms or conventions on this. And there are lots of activities afoot. Susan Martin at the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown is working on a project, but other folks are as well. This needs to be a growing set of norms have to develop. There's a process called the Nansen process that UNHCR is working with. It's not our project, but a number. It's a state-led process that we're contributing to, which looks at the likely flows due to climate change. You're right. It's not in our mandate. Eventually, it's going to be in someone's mandate, and I don't know whether it'll be ours. Will it be a new organization? We'll have to see how the international community wants to deal with this. But there will have to be norms on flow. So far, most of the people displaced by climate change, by natural disasters, have stayed inside their own countries. This is true in the Philippines. Think around the Pakistani floods. There've been very few people who have gone across borders. What's more likely to happen is on actual climate change, we have these you know, sort of long processes that radically change, not just a natural disaster that it'll go, a typhoon goes away and people can move back, but you have, you know, desertification or water in Bangladesh. I mean, eventually you will have people flowing across borders because they will never be able to return or at least sustain the lives they had in the place they are. And we need some new thinking on that, and it's underway, but we're not there yet.
There's actually an article in the New York Times this morning about the Filipinos from Leyte Island who are moving to other cities in the Philippines now in rather large numbers. So that internal displacement is something in prospect. This is a good time to turn to Luca Dallario of the International Organization for Migration.
Thank you, Catherine. Now, my question is about statelessness. UNHCR is also concerned with statelessness. And what are the legal and advocacy tools at the disposal of UNHCR to, particularly to prevent statelessness? In this region, of course, in the Dominican Republic, we have a situation now that could expose hundreds of thousands of Dominicans of Haitian descent to be stripped of nationality. probably not with the consequences of deportation, consequences on their human rights. How do you see the role of UNHCR in that context, and what kind of initiatives could be promoted? Yeah.
This is part of our core mandate, is working on statelessness. It was under the statelessness conventions of 50 and 40 years ago, the Secretary General was authorized to designate an organization to worry about statelessness, and that's us. We've had this mandate for a while. We've stepped up our activities dramatically over the last couple of years on statelessness. In some ways, statelessness should be easier to deal with in refugee crises because it often just requires a change in a law, right? It's a stroke of a pen can end statelessness. But sometimes it's more intractable politically because the groups that have been deemed stateless or not citizens of the country are ones the country doesn't want to incorporate. So there are these, ultimately it's a political issue. But we have projects around the world now on statelessness, working to try to change laws, change practices, get people documentation. A lot of the people we count as stateless are not in fact stateless, but they lack documentation. So we're in favor of getting them documentation. Our executive committee this year adopted a conclusion on birth registration, which is another way to, it doesn't give you citizenship. One of the concerns from countries was that birth registration would mean that people are automatically citizens of that country. It doesn't mean that. It means it's something, someone simply has a document when they're born, that they were born, what their name is, who their parents were, and what day they were born, which is often crucial for the assertion of rights later down the road. So we're involved in a widespread role of activities. We are quite concerned about the recent change of law, the turn of events in the Dominican Republic. We've worked closely with Dominican authorities on the Haitian issue, and we are troubled by the potential that those decisions will have towards contributing to statelessness.
Could you just say one sentence about those decisions, Alex, about this is children of Haitian descent born in the Dominican Republic?
Yeah, many of whom had lived, people, several generations back had come to Haiti as migrant workers and been given a kind of documentation that didn't establish their permanent residency, and then under a change in the law then ratified by the Supreme Court in the Dominican Republic, they were held not to have Dominican nationality.
Thanks. Yes, please.
Hi, Patty McElravy from Interaction. I just wanted to go back to your comment about Eritrea and the refugee. I'm assuming you're talking about Shimelba camp, but possibly others. As we know, there's no active war that they're fleeing. I mean, this is related to political and development issues in Eritrea and the fact that Eritrea has refused to stand down their war with Ethiopia, though it's some time ago that it's been there. So having visited that camp, I mean, the dynamics of that is the demographics of that camp is also another issue. It's, very much male predominantly, unless there's been a big change since I visited a few years back. I'm just wondering, and then you look at Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, the challenging political issues there, as well as development gains being at risk. What is UNHCR doing to kind of change its mindset or adapting to the fact that some of these issues really require not just a response mentality, but actually an active engagement on the country development strategies, in either the host countries or in the origin countries, to try and either stem the flow or to manage the flow that's entering? So, I mean, has this changing environment, how have you adapted within UNHCR to this?
Not yet. I mean, this would be the fourth role, I guess, for development in UNHCR, is to work on root causes. There was a time, it was about 20 years ago, where there was a lot of writing in the refugee world about root causes, and it didn't go very anywhere. And it's because, at least from our small little humble agency, it's difficult to either produce world peace or stop conflicts or to undertake major development projects in sending countries. So we are focused much more on helping people who have been forced to flee. It'd be great if we could work on reasons why people flee, but that really has to be, I think, the work of other agencies and the Security Council and the other organizations that try to keep peace.
I guess I would say is, what are you doing in partnership with them? And obviously no one agency can do anything altogether, the whole purpose of the structured dialogue last year. But I do think there's things in terms of information sharing and liaison and highlighting. I mean, do you have special role you're playing in that, or increasing a role in that?
We haven't to date. I mean, I can't think of major efforts we have where we have focused on home country development conditions. But I've got some very smart colleagues here that I'm going to ask a question about. I'm going to ask John Frederickson whether he can think of any examples, or Jana Mason in the, sitting in the second row here. Any thoughts on this question? John is our representative in Ecuador, and before that had a distinguished career with NGOs in the United States.
I think that the issue is the,
bring the mic up closer.
We need to get away with this false divide in between humanitarian work and development work. At least in the experience, when you work in a country that has the tools, like in Ecuador, where you can actually make change happen from the ground up with local authorities and national government. And we tend to live in this world of dichotomy, you know, and the worst expression, in my opinion, is maturity and wisdom, is this relief to development. As you said, Alex, relief and development go together. And when you have the tools, in a case like in Ecuador, for example, where refugees are identified as one of the six vulnerable groups within a constitutional norm, the others are people that have these capacities, multicultural settings, women at risk, and refugees are one of them. And we haven't been able to use that tool in order to apply, you know, development strategies, because we keep saying we're not a development agency. And we're not, but we're not just a humanitarian agency either. You know, I used to say a while back, don't box me in. Mm-hmm. We have a duty, as you say, Alex, to find solutions for refugees. And those solutions are going to be in the development area, because we cannot stay there forever. And we won't. We don't have the money. So it's a little bit of a cultural change. What we're doing in Ecuador is that we're finally doing a multi-annual planning process rather than a yearly planning process in terms of our strategies, our outputs, our outcomes. And I do think that UNHCR is much more engaged worldwide with the UN system in these development assistance frameworks than we were, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago. But it is a slow cultural change that's not going to happen quickly.
I think the one place that we're working, we're more likely to work on protection issues in a sending country than development issues. So I think about Colombia, actually, where there are the UNHCR presence in Colombia, which is 3 million internally displaced people, is almost entirely a protection function. And I've been on the rivers in western Colombia where we have our protection operations, where we try to keep protect people so they don't have to flee, that they're be able to be taken care of. I think about this in Kyrgyzstan, where there was a large flow into Uzbekistan a few years ago, and people have come back. But we work in through community services to try to keep peace in the return area of Kyrgyzstan so people don't flee again. So I think that's the root cause work we do is tends more to be on the protection side, the development side. But I agree with John, and I hope when I reach his age that I've got the same kind of wisdom and maturity.
I think this sort of concept of livelihoods is kind of a bridging strategy between the sort of humanitarian response and the development actors, and certainly we do see a lot more attention to that in UNHCR. Thanks in part to Alex. Yes, please.
My name is Sang-Wan Yoon from Bloomberg News. I wanted to go back to the point about increasing private sector's participation in these efforts. So far, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that corporations have been getting involved through philanthropic foundations of their own and from a CSR perspective. But if you're going to broaden it out from a private, from a corporation's perspective, it also has to make economic sense for them to join in. And if you could talk a little bit more about the economic potential of refugee communities, say an example of Syrian refugees in Lebanon. I mean, the economy in Lebanon has just been degrading. The debt levels are double what the average little income that the Syrian refugees get on a monthly basis. So if you could talk a little bit more about that. And secondary to that is, if you could talk a little bit more about what sort of innovation needs you're seeing now for Syrian refugees in Lebanon. And you said you're getting a lot of ideas on different issues, but something a little bit more on that would be great.
Okay. So on the first, we'd like to engage with the private sector in lots of ways. One is through corporate social responsibility, and that's great. And corporations, you know, multinational corporations are world citizens. They have operations everywhere, and they should be helping out the world that they have profited from being involved in, and that goes with good citizenship. But we're also happy to work with companies who want to make some money and provide opportunities for refugees. I was actually talking recently with a major corporation that has some factories in Thailand. And I said, well, we've got these refugees who can't work, but maybe we can go to the government and you take some of the refugees into the factory and we talk to the government about permitting that kind of work authorization. Why not? I mean, that would be a great thing. This is a company that we've partnered with for other through corporate social responsibility, but let's then take it to the next step. I think we're open to any of those kinds of suggestions. And the shelter situation is another one where we will produce this form of shelter through a grant from the IKEA Foundation that helped these companies develop this new kind of shelter, but then we're going to sell it, and one of them will produce it, and they'll make money. We'll put it out as open source, but someone's going to actually ultimately, we will ultimately buy these shelters, we hope, in the tens of thousands. That'll make someone a lot of money if they can produce them. So there are lots of ways that the private sector can engage with us, but the crucial thing is to recognize that we need and want the help of the private sector. The private sector is amused by UNHCR and by the UN, particularly, like I used to work in the academy in higher education, and higher education time is a little slower than private sector time, but UN time is much slower than private sector time. So, you know, a decision that will be made in a night in a private company, we can take a good 6 to 8 months on, you know, in the UN. So there's a culture change that has happened. And when I actually talk about this with private companies, I say to them, yeah, we want your help and your money, and let's all go do good humanitarian things. But I also say, we want you to help us change our culture. You do have ways of doing work. So I've tried to bring in experts on supply chain, logistics, how we do our HR system. I've had a major employment company come in and sit in our HR department for a few weeks and say, so, you know, what should we do differently based on your knowledge of HR? So there's all sorts of stuff that we can, it's not just money, it can be talent as well. And I think the UN has to be open to that kind of stuff. And there's, you know, there's still some hesitancy that it's it's impure in some way, but these are problems that are bigger than any of us, and we need all the help we can get with people who have smart ideas. In Lebanon, we're still in the very much in the emergency phase in Lebanon, and there has been some support, just cash from through corporate social responsibility. But I assume once that stabilizes more, and if people don't go back, we'll be looking for kind of employment opportunities. I mean, basically, in sort of macroeconomic terms, a refugee flow produces a large workforce in an area, often in an area because refugee camps are usually put in sparse areas where there hasn't been a labor force before. And then the economic question becomes, how do you take now often a talented workforce or just a manual worker or a farming workforce, whatever, and make it, give it gainful employment. And it should be a development issue for the place they settle in. My dream would be, if we get this right, is you'd have communities competing to be refugee hosting communities, because it would come with development funds that would ultimately be used to development, and businesses that would sign up to put their plants there and help do it. Now, we're a long, long way from that, but that's, I don't think that's a crazy dream, ultimately.
One more question in the back, and I think this will be our last one.
Hi, I'm Abby Brule with Interaction. I just wanted to pick up on your previous comments, as well as the intersection of humanitarian and development, and the need to really put these kind of ideas and words into action. And it seems to me that in the Syria context and the RRP6, there is an opportunity to do so with engaging development, particularly as the donors as well, to really get them on board. But so just wondering how you plan on doing that, but also keeping in mind that, you know, humanitarian and development actors kind of work on different timelines, as well as in often in different contexts as well. So just wondering how UNHCR is planning to ensure that these ideas and words are actually being translated into activities and to programs in the surrounding countries.
Yeah, the RRP6 will include a number of these kind of development projects. And the way we're trying to work together, and it's not easy, right? With different timelines, different vocabularies, different ways that we relate. But we have formed groups in both Amman and in Beirut, with the World Bank, with UNDP, where we're trying to find common ways to talk. And the partnership has gone really surprisingly well. I mean, we've done joint assessment missions where we go to communities and look at what's really needed here. Is it a garbage collection and a garbage plant? Is it more water? Is it, you know, we look at these infrastructural projects and try to prioritize those that can be done quickly, with a variety of sources of income that will make an impact in those communities. But it's a new way of working for both of us, and you're right that, you know, but, and I would just put the one final comment on what John said about that we're not just a humanitarian organization. You know, the UN divides things into development and humanitarian. We're actually a protection agency. Now, I know when you say that in the United States, it sounds like something else, a protection agency, but that's our core mandate. I don't think about our core mandate in terms of groups, like it's refugees, IDPs, stateless. I think about our core mandate as providing protection and seeking solutions. That's what our statute says. And the humanitarian stuff that we've now become identified with, the assistance, was an afterthought in the statute. And I think it's great, the money we raise and the lives we save with that assistance, but that's not what we were created to do. We were created to provide protection, which is establishment of rights and registration and recognition of people's status. You know, UNHCR started as a bunch of lawyers, really, that were issued documents to people, and we've grown into this huge assistance organization, and that's great. We do great work. I wouldn't take any of that away, but we can't forget that ultimately we are a protection agency worried about people's rights and their human dignity.
And ways that they can stop being refugees as soon as possible. Alex, thank you. It's always a pleasure, and to welcome you back to MPI, we hope we'll have many opportunities in the future to have this kind of conversation again. I'd like to thank you all for coming and to draw your attention to a leaflet that's on your chairs and invite you to one of the happiest MPI events, our E Pluribus Unum Awards, which are taking place on December 4th to recognize outstanding accomplishments in immigrant integration in the United States. So please join us there if you are able. And please join me in thanking Alex for a terrific conversation today.
For more information on MPI's Refugee Protection Program, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/refugee.php.